So, welcome everyone to this Lady Margaret lecture. So these lectures are named after our foundress, Lady Margaret Beaufort, who had herself a keen interest in governance, and her son became Henry VII, and the Tudor dynasty followed from that. I think she'd have been interested to know whether governance had become harder since then. We're very pleased to have Peter Riddle with us this evening, and that'll be his topic. Peter's first part of his career was as a journalist, and from 1991 to 2010, he was political commentator for The Times and assistant editor there. Prior to this, he was US editor and Washington bureau chief at the Financial Times between 1989 and 1991. From 2010 to 2012, he was one of the three members of the detainee inquiry, a Privy Councillor panel looking at whether the British government was implicated in the improper treatment of detainees held by other countries. So, issues concerned with Guantanamo Bay, rendition, etc. Peter took up the directorship at the Institute of Government at the start of 2012, and at the Institute he's co-authored reports on transitions and ministerial effectiveness and has been closely involved in work on political and constitutional reform. He's been a regular broadcaster, has written seven books and delivered frequent lectures. He chaired the Hansard Society, a non-partisan charity which promotes understanding of Parliament and representative democracy. He's a Fellow of the Royal Historical Society, an Honorary Fellow of the Political Studies Association, and was one of the first recipients of the President's Medal of the British Academy, and he's an Honorary Fellow of Sydney Sussex College. So without further ado, let me welcome Peter Riddle to give tonight's Lady Margaret lecture. Peter.
Thank you very much indeed, Master, and it's very good to see here in the audience a lot of old friends, contacts and people I've known. In one case, since a tea party, I can't remember where it was, in 1969, and as well as people who taught me, and I'm very glad you mentioned Sydney Sussex with the Master of Sydney here and the number of Fellows of Sydney. I'd have added that very quickly. I'm honoured to... I ought to say first, I crave your forbearance because I got a stinking cold. That should have a beneficial result. I talk more slowly. If it isn't, audience protest, I encourage and say, please slow down. I'm honoured to have been asked to deliver one of the Lady Margaret lectures, not just by following in a long line of distinguished scholars, but also because, as the Master said, Lady Margaret Beaufort was not only the founder of this college, but also the mother of one of the main creators of the British state. Of course, to her son, Henry VII, governing was pretty hard. He faced challenges from the barons and threats to his hold on the throne. Although he was remarkably successful in raising revenue, using methods I think even the current HMRC might find a little draconian. I would not remotely compare the problems of current political leaders to his, though probably there are some similarities in what are now called the failed states of parts of the Middle East and Central Africa. My title and my theme are much more contemporary, and I'm with a number of historians in the audience. I'm very much aware that I've got to be very exact in my framing of what I want to argue. Of course, I wouldn't claim it was harder than at various periods of centuries ago. I'm talking in relation to the period, the nearly seven decades since the end of the Second World War. For roughly half that period, I've written about the problems of government as a journalist, and for the last half dozen years as part of the Institute for Government, which I've run for nearly 3 years. Let me just give a little, partly a plug, partly an explanation of the Institute. The Institute was set up in 2008 by David Sainsbury, Lord Sainsbury of Turville, the Chancellor of this university. After 6 years as Science and Universities Minister, he concluded that government didn't work very well. This is not about policy, but about how government operated. Via his Gatsby Foundation, Lord Sainsbury had the means to do something about it, and so founded the Institute as a non-partisan charity with a mission of improving the effectiveness of government. Based in Carlton Gardens, the former home of Lord Kitchener, we work closely with civil servants, special advisers and ministers on a range of projects, from improving policy making through financial management and the work of arm's length bodies, to the more obviously political and examining the work of the coalition and helping prepare politicians and parties to work in government. Both in my old journalist days and now at the Institute, I spent a lot of time talking to politicians and civil servants. including some represented in this audience. Contrary to the populist image propagated by anti-politicians, from Russell Brand to Nigel Farage, those at the top of Whitehall and Westminster don't feel complacent or really in charge. Rather, they often feel beleaguered, surrounded by pressures which make their lives more difficult, as well as being criticised at every turn. Looking at these trends across the world, Moise Naim made the point in his End of Power book that the world over, power no longer buys as much as it used to. In fact, power is eroding. It is easier to get, but harder to use, and far easier to lose. A politician can become prime minister only to discover that she is tied down by myriad minority parties that could veto her initiatives. Naim quotes Joschka Fischer, engaging Green former vice chancellor and foreign minister of Germany at the turn of the millennium. One of my biggest shocks was the discovery that all the imposing government palaces and other trappings of government were in fact empty places. The imperial architecture of governmental palaces masks how limited the power of those who work there really is. Revealingly, Naim subtitled his book, From Boardroom to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. Not quite the title of a musical, but... true, but a better subtitle might be How Power is Being Dispersed in Politics as Much as Business. The elusiveness and frustration to power are something I've been struck by in moving from a position of an outsider to someone to whom the door is at least half open. You think as a journalist that the minister, the special advisor and the civil servant have a secret and elaborately worked out plan. Too often, however, they're just watching the same 24-hour news channel as you, or nowadays following the Twitter link. Privately, many ministers and officials are in despair at the difficulty of addressing some urgent and important long-term challenges because of the fragmentation of power. And Britain is by no means the worst position. There is even greater pessimism in other parts of Europe and across the Atlantic in Washington. How real are these worries, and why have they arisen? There's a vast and growing literature on the malaise of democracies and the fall in trust in established institutions. At the Institute itself, this year alone, we've hosted speeches by Linda Colley, David Runciman, Roberta Unger, Francis Fukuyama, and John Micklethwaite, all bemoaning the problems faced by democracies. There is a widespread revolt against established political leaders, seen in the rise of the Tea Party movement in the United States, and in anti-immigrant and anti-EU parties in France, Germany, Greece, Hungary, Denmark, Sweden, and the Netherlands. There's no kind of clear line any longer, which you might have thought, between parts of Europe. It's very widespread. And of course, the UK. We now live in the era of the permanent campaign, in which political leaders and their advisers focus on winning the 24-hour news cycle. This short-termism has been fueled by the growth of the internet, Twitter, and other social media, which have made those in power more vulnerable. A decline in deference and an increase in partisanship have further restricted the freedom of manoeuvre of those in government. At the extreme, this produces what Francis Fukuyama calls a veto-ocracy in the United States, where there is deadlock in Congress, preventing the solution to deep-seated fiscal problems. Many of the frequently discussed manifestations of disenchantment with the established political process are symptoms rather than causes. The underlying reason is, I will argue, that governments are not fulfilling the public's expectations, that they're failing to perform what voters want. The key word is expectations. It's less what governments do than what voters expect them to do. Public expectations exceed what governments can deliver. The question is relative, not absolute. I don't share the declinist view that all is woe with government. Far from it. I was recently described as utopian by, of all people, the director of the Royal Statistical Society, almost like being accused of being brave and courageous. But I'm not a pessimist. Therefore, I found the central thesis of the widely discussed book, The Blunders of Our Governments, by Anthony King and Ivor Crewe, only partially convincing. For all the impact are there many vivid stories of big government projects going wrong, from the poll tax, through innumerable IT projects, to the problems of pensions mis-selling and the Rural Payment Agency. All true, and I will discuss some of the ways that government can be improved later in my lecture. But the authors were guilty of two faults. First, they focused almost entirely on Britain. And by highlighting specifically British weaknesses, they were in danger of taking too narrow a view of what has gone wrong. Germany, supposedly the exemplar of a well-run country, has faced the embarrassment of huge cost overruns for the new Berlin-Brandenburg airport, more than doubling its original cost, with delays to opening of more than 2 years. In France, 2,000 new trains were built too wide for many station platforms, again causing delays and substantial extra costs as stations were rebuilt. And the US has seen the painful introduction of the new healthcare system with multiple computer glitches when it was launched. So blunders are not a uniquely British phenomenon, and they don't have uniquely British causes. Moreover, what is not done is often as important as what is actually done. Second, by focusing on blunders, King and crew ignored where government has succeeded. 4 years ago, the Institute for Government held a series of workshops, which we call policy reunions, drawing lessons for 6 case studies of policy successes, some of which involve people in this audience. The privatisation of British Telecom, the introduction of the national minimum wage, Scottish devolution in 1997-99, I'll leave aside later Scottish things, perhaps people might want to raise that later, the Pensions Commission under Adair Turner in 2002-06, the ban on smoking in public places in 2007, perhaps most controversially, the Climate Change Act of 2008. We identified a number of common factors behind the success of these policies, which I'll discuss later. More generally, government in Britain, in many countries, is remarkably successful. Taxes are collected, pensions and benefits are paid, the laws more or less enforced. The NHS treats millions of patients every year, or rather extra patients every year, with procedures many of which were unavailable only a decade ago. But something is clearly wrong. Regular opinion research shows that government, not just in Britain, but elsewhere, has record low satisfaction ratings. The annual British Social Attitudes Survey showed that a proportion of people saying that they trust the government just about always, or most of the time, has halved to well under 20% over the past 3 decades. While the number saying they almost never trust the government has risen from 12% to around 40%. Similarly, a populist poll, which the Institute for Government commissioned this summer, showed that fewer than a fifth think that UK politicians make a priority of taking decisions about the long-term direction of the country, compared with two-fifths who think they should make this a priority. Similarly, just 15% think politicians make a priority of fulfilling the promises they made before getting elected, against 46% who think that they should do so. The underlying problem is dissatisfaction with the performance of government. I think there are 4 main reasons for this dissatisfaction. The first is economic and social change. Increased globalisation, open capital product, and above all labour markets have produced big divides between those who can compete and thrive and those who are left behind, in the memorable phrase of Robert Ford and Matthew Goodwin in their recent book Analysing the Rise of UKIP, Revolt on the Right, explaining support for the radical right in Britain. The left behind, emphatically Clacton Mann in a recent by-election, are older, unskilled, manual workers with little education who blame the government, Westminster, established politicians, all pulled together, for failing to look after them as their job opportunities have gone. Yet, of course, it is that same government whose welfare benefits are now sustaining them. It's a clear echo of the marvellous Tea Party poster at an anti-Washington rally a few years ago, hands off my Medicare and Social Security. Irony is not long on the radical right. The complaints about immigration and indirectly Europe are expressions of protest that the government has failed them and has not provided security in face of cross-border economic pressures and inward migration. By contrast, the well-educated audience in front of me represents the opposite, a group dependent on globalisation for its success. The same could be said of financial services in the city, Canary Wharf and Mayfair, the Silicon Roundabout and Old Street, which attracts not only Banksy, but also a large number of high-tech and digital entrepreneurs, as well as the creative industries spread across the capital and, of course, around Cambridge. For all these, nationality is secondary to talent. The increased internationalisation of Cambridge and other leading universities is dependent on an open country welcoming migrants, either temporary or permanent, from other countries who can enrich scholarship. The clash between Clacton man and woman and Cambridge man and woman epitomises this tension. The former wants to clamp down on immigration from whatever source, seen as a threat, while the latter complains about the difficulty of obtaining visas from scholars outside the European Union. Second factor, a combination of technological and demographic change has created acute long-term pressures. Advances in medical treatment, especially in the range of life-extending drugs and healthier diets, have led to dramatic increases in life expectancy. Over the next few decades, there will be more elderly people and fewer working age people. You just look at the annual fiscal sustainability report produced by the Office for Budget Responsibility. This could be read as an annex to my argument that governing is getting harder. The last report produced about 3 months ago, using as a benchmark unchanged policies, and you could debate that as a benchmark, but it's a perfectly good working assumption for the purposes of what I'm going to say this evening. The OBR projected that an ageing population will push up public spending, excluding debt interest, from just over 34% in 2018-19, that was the end of the current planning period, to over 39% by 2059-60. This is equivalent to £80 billion in today's money. About two-fifths of the increase is because of the additional health spending, nearly half from higher state pension costs, despite the planned rise in the state retirement age we're going to see over the next a decade or more, and the rest coming from higher long-term social care costs. And these, the assumptions lying behind that one has to be very careful on. The OBR concludes that governments will, over time, need to find new sources of revenue to maintain the overall ratio of revenue to national income. Let alone to meet the spending pressures from an ageing population. So to avoid an increase in the tax burden, they will have to find these new sources of revenue. Overall, the OBR states, or rather understates, you could argue, that on current policy, we would expect the budget deficit to widen sufficiently over the long term to put public sector net debt on a continuously rising trajectory as a share of national income. This would be unsustainable. In short, something will have to give. Third factor, the so-called nice decade of non-inflationary growth was brought to an abrupt end by the financial crisis of 2008. The resulting spiralling of deficits, debt and slow growth constrains all Western governments. The recovery is far from established, as the latest market jitters show, with the public and private sector debt problems still a long way from being resolved. There is a prospect of further austerity for some years to come, with the main disagreement not about the direction of fiscal action, but its speed and balance. In the UK, there have been substantial cuts to public spending plans since 2010, reflected in a reduction of civil service numbers of approaching a fifth over the five-year parliament to the lowest peacetime level for more than 70 years. It's quite stark statistics. People rather neglect that. The shrinking of Whitehall is very dramatic. As a parenthesis, the Institute of Government produces every year what called a Whitehall Monitor, which is a kind of almanac of what happens in government. We did the first one a year ago, and the second one is coming out next month. And I actually suggested we ought to look at what happened to the Whitehall estate. And it's actually very striking the number of buildings, which a number of people in this audience will be very familiar with, which are now empty. Yesterday I was walking past Admiralty Arch. There was a state visit of the President of Singapore. Well, actually, it's now empty before it becomes a hotel. And there are a lot of other buildings. That's a dramatic illustration of a contraction in central government, which, to my mind, symbolises a lot of the changes. But the surprising feature is how ritualistic and limited the protests have been until now. It's hard to argue that the 2011 inner-city riots were caused by the cuts rather than long-standing disaffection and criminal opportunism. One reason for the limited response so far, and I emphasise so far, may be the big spending increases from 2000 to 2008, including some padding and inefficiencies, which could and have been eliminated without affecting standards of service too much. A lot of money has come from a tight squeeze on public sector pay, a large element in total spending. There are exceptions, notably in social services, where sizeable cutbacks have increased pressures on the NHS and A&E departments, reflected in a very sharp increase in admissions to A&E. And the defence cuts have affected the ability of the UK to intervene and mount operations. However, there's little dispute that from now onwards, some very difficult choices will have to be taken on the extent of state provision, going well beyond pay squeezes and efficiency drives. I don't think we're in the position of the 1930s of cuts in nominal pay for civil servants, but you know, when you're talking about 1% or frozen, you're talking about a very draconian situation. And it raises questions about should the government withdraw from providing some services or charge for others. This is where the clash of expectations comes in. I must confess, like a number of people in this audience, to being a guilty party here as a baby boomer. At the upper end of that age spectrum, with the youngest passing the 50 mark this year. We are the generation that benefited from largely free university education, ample job opportunities. I can't remember any of my contemporaries at Cambridge when I left in 1970 not getting a job. Rising house prices, if we're lucky, generous pension provision and substantial subsidies now. These opportunities will not be open to our children. Fourth factor, the political context for governing has become more demanding. The age of deference, as I mentioned earlier, is gone. Voters no longer accept what government provides. Used to choice over consumer goods and in their leisure activities, people are increasingly assertive in relation to what the state provides. Knowledge used to be held almost exclusively by the state, as it provided universal benefits and services. Now the citizen can use the internet, become both better informed and to exercise choice in the use of services. This is allied to a growing culture of rights, in which interest groups are more willing and able to challenge the state via, for example, the growth of judicial review. That's a whole big subject on its own, which can happily be explored on another occasion. In many respects, these are desirable changes. Accountability and responsiveness are essential components of any democracy, but they don't make governing any easier, as shown by the frequent complaints by usually ex-ministers about the impact of freedom of information legislation. I can't count the number of times I've had privately some current ministers as well as ex-ministers complain about FOI legislation. Allied to that is a lack of self-confidence in the governing classes. Far from being arrogant and remote, they're hyper-conscious of public opinion, which is constantly being expressed in polls and in focus groups. This makes political leaders risk-averse, unwilling to challenge what is taken as majority opinion. Add to that the fragmentation of parties in many of the main democracies, reducing the authority of the traditional ruling parties. Just to give the UK example, the share of the vote taken by the two main parties has fallen from 97% or more in 1950 and 51 to barely 65% in the last two general elections, with barely any sign of a shift upwards in the combination. It'd be very surprising if next year might be slightly over 65, but the idea of any return to the figures which are quite normal, the big change occurred in 74 for various reasons. Gone are the days when an opposition party in the UK could confidently expect to have the support of well over 40% of voters going into an election campaign. And that has very big effects on the potential authority of a government. Governments lack the will and authority to tackle pressing problems. One of the downsides of minority government and coalitions is a tendency towards lowest common denominator fudges, in which each side's favourite programmes are protected. In this respect, it's remarkable how much the current coalition government in Britain has actually done in health, welfare changes, university finance, and so on. There's also a long list, and particularly I'm grateful because with Charles Clarke here, of two difficult to handle questions, which he very well covers in the book he edited, which came out a few months ago. I just give the examples: airport capacity in southeastern England, long-term energy supplies, the provision of more housing and other infrastructure projects, where local pressures and political challenges hold up decisions. And there are many more too. The challenges of governing are much worse in many other developed countries, notably in the USA, where agreement on a long-term budget deal balancing higher taxes and cutbacks in spending looks unattainable, in the process meaning that some needed infrastructure investment is postponed, or in France, where entrenched interest groups and political divisions prevent needed reforms. The overall position was well summarised earlier this year by John Micklethwaite and Adrian Woolridge of The Economist in their book The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State. They say such antipathy towards politics might not matter much if voters wanted little from the state, but they continue to want a great deal. The result is a toxic mixture. Dependency on government on the one hand and disdain for government on the other. The dependency forces government to overexpand and overburden themselves, while the disdain robs governments of their legitimacy and turns every setback into a crisis. Democratic dysfunction goes hand in hand with democratic distemper. This has led to a lively debate about sustainability of the familiar Western democratic model in face of insurgent populism and electoral and legislative stalemate. These trends have been brilliantly analysed by Francis Fukuyama in two hefty volumes, which analyse the distinct components of a successful society. He analyses them into three parts: a strong state, the rule of law, and democratic accountability. Democracy is actually usually followed the other two. And I think one of the advantages of his book, he does clarify the links between democratic accountability and the strength of the state. I mean, in the UK example, very vividly, democracy followed a long way from both the rule of law and the existence of a strong state, which indeed the son of the founder of this college did his bit in creating. Fukuyama also highlights the paradox, first evident during the Thatcher years, that the only force that can rein in the state is a more powerful state. He's particularly pessimistic about the United States, where lax campaign finance laws and concentrations of wealth have allowed groups to manipulate the system in their own interest, leading to a weaker, less efficient, and more corrupt state. The public is distrustful of the state and starves of it of resources and authority. The success of American entrepreneurs, as epitomised by what happens on both coasts, around Boston and from Silicon Valley down, further down to LA and San Diego, is increasingly despite rather than because the state, except insofar as, of course, the wealthy engineer tax and regulatory changes to favour them. There have been parallel warnings about a decline in democracy across the world, not just in the Middle East, but in countries as diverse as Guinea, Honduras and Fiji, while in other countries, such as Pakistan, the military rather than elected politicians remain the key players. There's been, in response to that, and particularly in response to the growth of the and success of competition from Asia, there's been interest in the so-called Asian model, exemplified by China and in a less dramatic fashion by Singapore, with its combination of prosperity, discipline, sweltering heat and smugness. As someone said, it's Disneyland with capital punishment designed by a magic consultant. There are certainly lessons to be learnt from the way Singapore runs its public services, but not in the wholesale application of its narrow political model. David Runciman, Professor of Politics here in Cambridge, has offered a more optimistic response in his lively book, The Confidence Trap: A History of Democracy in Crisis from World War I to the Present. He takes the muddling along view. Democratic politics is noisy, diverted by scandals and short-term diversions, but is ultimately adaptable. Or rather, well-established democracies are, as opposed to shallowly rooted ones like Weimar Germany, Italy, Japan and Portugal, which lasted for barely a decade, and often less than a decade, after the First World War. Autocracies, he argues, tend to crack under pressure, though often only after a long time, as with the Soviet Union. It did, after all, last from 1917 until 1991, and you could argue what's happening now suggests what happened in the 1990s was a kind of interim. On the Runciman view, democracies can be ruthless and resilient when faced with crises like wars and financial upheaval. The UK mobilised resources far more effectively than Nazi Germany during the war, particularly in the mobilisation of labour. Yet China, and this is a kind of counter to his thesis, that China has shown its ability to adapt as when Deng Xiaoping overturned Maoist economic policies over 30 years ago. This was a very important and very interesting exception. I'm an instinctive believer in muddling through, but it doesn't happen automatically. Action has to be taken. One of the main responses to the messiness of government has been to trust the technocrats. This started in the 1990s with the vogue for independent central banks running monetary policy. This worked well for a time, though the narrowness with which the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve in the US interpreted their inflation mandates meant that they were not alert to the growing debt bubble 10 years ago. They neglected the systemic risks. I mean, there was a clear fault there, and which emerged. By focusing just on monetary conditions, they didn't really take account of whether money was being lent to and whether that was sustainable or not. Or in the case of Alan Greenspan, they believed there were self-correcting mechanisms in that. For the last five or six years, they've adopted politician and voter-friendly policies of supplying credit and holding down interest rates, which looks like continuing for some time. The technocratic response has also spread to other areas, notably competition policy, and to the proliferation of ethical regulators affecting most professions in the wake of various scandals. This is not the place to explore the fascinating issues of transparency and trust, which themselves deserve a lecture, but they're very interesting ones, affecting, again, a search for some outside validation of behaviour. But more broadly, there is a tension between searching for a non-political solution to a problem because the politicians are not trusted, and demands for accountability to voters. One sees that all the time, complaints that someone is not elected and therefore shouldn't be saying something, yet combined with not trusting the politicians. I mean, if I can give you a particular illustration of this, the expenses scandal of MPs in 2009 led to some very hurried legislation to create a new regulator, IPSA, to deal with MPs' expenses. The MPs moan and groan about it and say it's too bureaucratic, but and say they're unelected, they're regulating us, but fail to take account of the failures of MPs, expose the weaknesses in the previous system. So who has confidence in a solution? On a broader area, we saw what happened to the technocratic governments in Italy and Greece, and to the resentment, which continues, against the power of the European Central Bank now in the Eurozone countries. We have demands in the UK for commissions or groups of experts to examine problems and come up with solutions. And royal commissions are out of fashion. As Harold Wilson's wonderfully cynical formula, they take minutes to set up and years to report. But I think there is a role for such inquiries, not royal commissions, but there is a role for inquiries, but not as a substitute for the policy process, but to assist it. I don't have any magic solutions. All I would say is that governments can tackle long-term problems. I gave some examples earlier. I think the UK record in addressing pensions is actually far better than many other countries, because it had taken up the idea, which I'll refer to in a minute, of consultation and of broadening the policy debate. It's partly a matter of political authority, but David Cameron was unquestionably correct in creating a coalition in May 2010. The creation of the coalition gave them the authority to tackle what was a very pressing problem. I mean, we tend to forget that during the general election then, there were TV pictures of the riots in Greece, the worries over what was happening then. There was the fear that a minority government would not have the authority to do what was necessary. Now, you can argue about some of the consequences of it, but undoubtedly having the authority through the coalition has enabled difficult decisions to be tackled. That is where, but it's also partly a matter of understanding the nature of the problem. That's why commissions and reviews at a distance from the day-to-day work of government can help. Going back to the policy successes reunions, which the Institute organised 4 years ago, common features were time. Not rushing decisions, but opening up the policy process, being rigorous in the use of evidence, then taking time for discussion, and building up a consensus on the need for change. It's very easy to talk about that, much harder to do in practice, and I recognise that. But there are some issues where it's happened. I mentioned pensions. Introduction of national minimum wage, very interesting, very divisive issue before the 1997 election, but actually introduced in a way which has persisted and has been accepted. And indeed, when some politicians have argued about raising the national minimum wage to a certain level, there's been a reply from the Commission which fixes the wages. Hold on, we have a process here which gets the acceptance of better industry and unions. Very interesting argument, that. Something which, going back to pre-97, people wouldn't necessarily have predicted, that you'd have a process which actually establishes widespread consent. Consultation and wider involvement are not a technocratic substitute for politics, but a crucial underpinning for successful political leadership. The pensions thing only worked because Adair Turner produced his ideas. He actually faced resistance from Gordon Brown and the Treasury, quite stiff resistance, but with the support of various work and pension ministers, and ultimately Tony Blair in No. 10 Downing Street, got the political support for the changes, which were then had a wider consensus behind them. The same has happened more recently on funding long-term care for the elderly. The result is that the UK is much better placed than, say, Italy and France in handling the demands of an ageing population. There is, of course, much further to go. Notably in attitudes to work for those in their late 60s and early 70s, and in integrating social care and the NHS, one of the real challenges for the next Parliament. There's also huge scope to improve the efficiency of administration, to adapt the digital revolution to government services, but so far only a small start has been made, but potential efficiency savings are huge. Similarly, the present government, to its credit, has recognised the need to overhaul the running of major projects, procurement, the outsourcing of services, but the record is very, very patchy. IT, financial management and so on. The long established structure of departments, the kind of Haldane structure of 1918, may also be in question, since many functions and services can be shared to reduce costs. There's also the example of the unified government in Scotland. The most interesting thing is, if you visit Edinburgh, it's not just the endless debates about devolution and independence, but government works differently there. There aren't any departments. They're just one government. And that increases the chances of tackling ingrained problems such as deprivation in early years and the unhealthy lifestyles which have sharply reduced life expectancy. There is scope to reshape government to be more adaptable and responsive to changing social and economic trends. I'm wary of going too far down the road of reinventing government, a slogan of the kind of early Blair and Al Gore's influence on the Clinton administration. There's a real danger of sounding over enthusiastic. I mean, if you hear the advocates of digital and so on, you sometimes forget there is actually something called policy and the differences in values. They reduce everything to a transaction over the internet, and there are big differences in values, which is what politics is all about. The key point is actually the answers are not technocratic. Commissions of the wise from Cambridge, though I have no doubt economic policy would benefit from what happened a century ago, when a young Don from King's travelled down to London on the sidecar of his brother-in-law's motorbike. This was in early August 1914, because the trains were full with recruits. from the station. And this is on a Sunday. He'd received a postcard that morning from London. Again, another illustration of the change in time over the last century. The young Don from King's got out at the end of Whitehall to smarten himself up and popped in to answer the summons from a Treasury official concerned about the financial crisis, which was then enveloping not only London, but the financial capitals of the world. "Who is this Keynes?" Lloyd George asked, the last time he ever asked that question. The answers then, as now, were essentially political. It's no good hiding behind central banks and commissions. That won't persuade disaffected voters. Government is harder than it was in the 1950s, but, I suggest, it's still not impossible. Thank you very much.